rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher, and you're listening to our special series examining just what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup in the company of those who have been there and done it. We'll take you from 1987 to 2019 through the eyes of great world champions ahead of the 10th World Cup in France this autumn. We'll hear their memories and stories, anecdotes and insights, all with the goal of answering one simple but devilish question. How do you win the World Cup? So join us on a rugby journey to whet your appetite for France with Legends of the Game. This time on How to Win the World Cup, we begin right back where it started with the first ever World Cup winners, New Zealand. In 1985, the International Rugby Football Board finally vote through a proposal to begin a World Cup, and 2 years later, Australia and New Zealand team up to host it. In 1987, Whitney Houston wants to dance with somebody, Rick Astley is never going to give you up, and a family called the Simpsons welcome us to Springfield for the first time. Rugby is still 8 years away from turning professional, but New Zealand's All Blacks hardly look like amateurs. The Kiwis blast through the tournament, smashing Scotland, Wales and France to lift the World Cup at Eden Park. One of the first men to get his hands on the trophy was Sean Fitzpatrick, the legendary All Blacks hooker. So, from The Times and The Sunday Times, this is a Ruck special, How to Win the World Cup with Sean Fitzpatrick. Okay, Sean, what a delight it is to start our rip round the last 9 World Cups with you. Talking about 1987. Thanks so much for joining us. Now, we're going to ask all of our guests one question through the special series to kick off. So without further ado, how do you win the World Cup? Sean Fitzpatrick.
How do you win the World Cup?
Yeah.
I think times have changed a bit since 87 in terms of, you know, in 87, no one really knew what a World Cup was. It was about winning every game. But I suppose in reflection, we had a team where everyone in their positions were pretty good at what they did. And we had a bit of depth also. Although in those days we were only allowed 26 players. I look at that World Cup final and, you know, any one of those 26 could have probably started and there wouldn't have been a much of a drop off in the performance of the team. So I think depth in your squad is pretty important. And, you know, we wanted to be the first team in the world to win a World Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
Ever. And that was our main sort of catch cry, really.
Well, we'll try and find an answer by the end of our chat, but why don't we lay the context for our listeners? So, Sean, talk us through the rugby scene in the 80s then. Take us back. Lots of tours, no Tri Nations yet down south, but suddenly there's a World Cup, a properly global competition to get stuck into. What was the scene like for you guys at that time?
New Zealand rugby in sort of the mid-80s was in a bit of distress in terms of there's a lot of unrest in terms of the Cavaliers. We had a Cavaliers tour in 1986 to South Africa, where we had the whole All Black team that went to the Cavaliers were all banned for two matches. And it gave a lot of us young kids an opportunity to get into the All Blacks. So in 87 and 86, we lost to Australia. So then we went away to France at the end of the year, and we lost our last game to the French in Nantes. The Battle of Nantes. Mm. And I suppose then it was Brian Lahore was our coach, and he decided to have a bit of a changing of the guard, really, in 87. A lot of new kids came into the team, and we had to win back the fans because they'd sort of gone off the All Blacks a bit, believe it or not. And I think the opening game at the World Cup and at Eden Park was a reflection of that, when we only had sort of 13,000 people turned up to support us. So it was a time to change the attitude of the team and also of the public. So we took the All Blacks to New Zealand, which was a great lot of fun.
Yeah, so that Cavaliers tour, just for listeners that might not remember, obviously South Africa were in sporting isolation due to apartheid, but some of you guys made the decision to go to that tour, and that obviously caused a massive stink, didn't it? So, as you say, you tried to win
sort
them
of
back.
Divided the country, really. Mm. You know, it was a follow-on from the 81 tour to New Zealand, where the government said, sport is sport and politics is politics, so you do what you like. The South Africans came to New Zealand, and in 85 the tour was cancelled, so in 86 they had a rebel tour. So thankfully that's all changed now, and we were allowed back in there officially in 1992.
So tell us about the prep then, because as you say, you trained around the country, schools and towns, to reconnect with the public in New Zealand. So what do you remember of those preparation times? Because obviously at that point you're all amateur players, so did you have to kind of quit your jobs and go train at all these different places around the country?
No, not really. There wasn't a lot of preparation. I think we had one trial up in Northland. The probables played the possibles, I think 10 days before the team was named. Before we assembled on a Wednesday. So there was very little preparation. There was no fitness camps. It was up to the individual. We all worked. I was a builder. So I was on a building site getting fit, basically. And we had the trial, after the trial, into the after-match function under the stand as we all waited. And they named the 26 players that were going to the World Cup straight after the game. And we assembled the following Wednesday to prepare for our game on the Saturday against Italy. So very little preparation. And for us as All Blacks in those days, it was about the next game. Winning the next game was the most important thing. And as I said, Brian Lahore said to us, we have the opportunity to be the first team to win the inaugural World Cup. And that was it. We had to win six games. And that was basically our preparation. And, the introduction of some young players.
Take us into that scene underneath the stands. I mean, lots of squads have been announced for this World Cup, and down in New Zealand they had Richie McCaw and a big unveiling of the 33 men going to the World Cup this year. But that sounds like so low-key, doesn't it? What were you feeling when you were standing under the stands?
Just standing under the stand, and, some of the guys missed out, which is very, very sad. But I was, 22 years old. And I honestly, the captain was a guy called Andy Dalton. He was 12 years older than me. And to be in the squad, I grew up, watching the likes of Andy Dalton. And to be named in a team with him, I was just so relieved to be in the team. And then looking at the players that missed out, the Hicker Reeds of the world, I felt very honoured, really excited. And that was it, really. And then the next morning, I think we woke up, and before we left Northland and Whangarei, we signed 100 rugby balls, which we'd never ever done anything like that before. There was no signing of jerseys, because you couldn't buy a replica jersey in those days, because that was just the way we did it.
Yeah, yeah. So talk to me about the whole World Cup thing, because it had been an initiative that rugby had tried to get going for a while, but there are a few in the Northern Hemisphere particularly who are against it. Clearly football, cricket, rugby league had all had World Cups for many years, but never rugby union. Was it something you thought that the sport was crying out for at the time, or did you not really think about it?
Not so much World Cups. I think New Zealand was really pushing for the game to go professional, which we saw as something that was needed for the sustainability of the game, really, and to make it a better product. You know, the Rugby World Cup was, I suppose, the start of that that process. And as I said, we didn't really think too much about a Rugby World Cup. You know, we played Scotland in the quarterfinal, we played Wales in the pool matches, we played Italy, and that was just... It was just honestly, it was just another game for us that we had to win.
Was there any talk you mentioned before that about that thing of, like, if it's the first World Cup, we might as well be the first ones to win it, and it's this almost ultimate chance to prove you're the best in the world, isn't it? To win a World Cup.
Yeah, I think to win a World Cup, and that's, you know, for us, we had Australia in our sights because they in '86 they were an outstanding team, and that was a massive game coming up. We thought. The French did us a nice favour in beating them in the semi-final. But now we were touring New Zealand, which had never been done before. Mm. Now, we'd never done a haka in New Zealand before because we never ever performed a haka at home. So Buck Shelford basically said to us, if you want to, you know, we're touring New Zealand, so let's perform the haka. But if we're going to perform the haka, we have to learn all about it. So we actually sat down and Buck took us through what was the meaning of the haka. And we had to do it properly. All those little things, you know, we in our coach Brian Lahore was a farmer from the Wairarapa, and you know, we went to his local pub, and the night that we thought we were going to Christchurch to prepare for the quarter final, he said to us, "Well, we're not going to Christchurch. We're staying in Eka Tahuna, and you're all going to be billeted with different families for a couple of nights." which was amazing, and if I can't see that happening today. But you know, he was staying on a farms. You know, I was with Richard Lowe, you know, staying with a lovely family who just thought their dreams had all come true.
What do you remember of the fact they must have been a bit surprised that a couple of All Blacks knocking on the door and say, "Can we have a bed for the night?"
Well, we didn't actually knock on the door. We were heading to the airport in Wellington after our quarter final against Argentina. Our last pool game, and we were heading to Christchurch for our quarterfinal against the Scots. And BJ said, "Well, we're going over to have lunch at my local pub in Eka Tahuna." And we turned up at the pub, and there was all these families and these trucks and utes outside with dogs barking, sheep in the back of them, bales of hay everywhere. And we walked into the pub, and it was full of all these families. So we thought, "Oh, this is great. We'll have a few beers, and then we'll head off to Christchurch." That's when Brian got up and said, "Well, we're not going to Christchurch tonight. You're staying in Eka Tahuna." And it was absolutely amazing. I look back at it with such fond memories and the joy that it brought the families. But honestly, for us, it was such a great thing to do. And once again, trying to take the game back to New Zealand to get them behind us.
Yeah, that's amazing. That it sounds like something that, I don't know, people who've gone on rugby tours overseas who listening to this, or that's the sort of thing that prep school boys do overseas, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like go and
exactly.
Stay with the family, learn about the culture.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Wonderful.
So talk us about, we've mentioned the fact that it was the amateur era, but professionalism is kind of creeping in and 8 years away. And I think the European players who came down south were maybe a little bit surprised at how commercialised maybe it was all becoming. And I think Steinlager sponsored the kicking tees and you guys were on billboards and stuff like that. Did it feel for you like it was becoming a big deal, this tournament?
I remember Andy Dalton, our captain. A few of the people from up north were a bit surprised to see him driving on the billboards on a quad bike. He was a farmer, and he was advertising whatever the quad bike brand was, or the Yamaha or Kawasaki or something. And there was a few rumblings about that. The game has been professional in New Zealand for years. But to be honest, we all had jobs. You know, we got leave without pay. Yeah, sure. I think Steinlager were involved in those days. But, you know, as players, we, you know, maybe got a tray of beer occasionally. But no, nothing else. It was just as it is today. And the guys, you know, although they get paid today, you know, the pride you get out of wearing the black jersey meant everything to us. And in those days also, we only played sort of 7 internationals a year and we went on tours. So, you know, a six-match tour it was for us. And the money was irrelevant. And, you know, we wanted to make sure that, you know, we improved the All Black jersey.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So looking at the games itself, in sort of a, well, in any context, you blasted through the tournament, really. Like, there were no real tight games, which is quite rare in a World Cup, looking at all the other ones. So from the matches, what particularly stands out for you? We'll get to the final in a second, but from the pool stages, quarter, the semi-final, which ones really stick in the memory all these years on?
I think, obviously, the opening game of the World Cup was, you know, against Italy, that was quite special. To play Fiji. I remember playing Fiji down in Christchurch in the pool games, and it really, you could just feel there was something brewing. The John Kerwin try against Italy sort of set it off. Michael Jones, no one had really seen him before, but he sort of changed the face of what number sevens in the world did. You know, Buck Shelford, you know, such a great warrior, great leader of men. And as I said, everyone just did their jobs. The Warwick Taylors, the Craig Greens, the John Gallaghers, Grant Fox, David Kirk. That was all sort of interesting. And then, you know, Andy Dalton injured his hamstring on the Wednesday before the first game. And we were doing fitness training on the Wednesday before the first game, which just seems bizarre. And unfortunately, Andy pulled a hamstring. And I can still remember Brian coming to my room. He said, well, Andy's out for a couple of weeks, so you're going to be the hooker, and we're not going to bring another hooker into the squad. And if we have an injury, if you get injured, we'll use Steve McDowell, our loosehead prop, to cover hooker. And Steve had one club game as a hooker, never throwing the ball in. But that was just the way it was in those days, you know, to go through those pool games. And then we got to the quarterfinal, and Andy was actually fit. And they said, no, we've done so well with the squad we've got, the team we've got, we're going to leave you in for the quarterfinal. And I was like, oh, my God, this is such a bloody honour. And that game against the Scots, we saw them as a real threat. They've always been a bit of a tough nut to crack for us, the Scots. And that game was no exception. You know, it was a tough, tough game. Although we won by 20-odd points, it was still a really physical, hard game. And then I remember going to Ballymore to play our semi-final against the Welsh. And it was really strange. We're playing Wales in Brisbane, which was probably something that really stood out for me as a difference, what the World Cup was doing, is, you know, putting us in Australia playing Wales. So that was a bit bizarre. And that game there, we just played a blinder again. And the team was just coming together nicely. And then I can still remember, whether it was that day or the next day, we watched Australia all together play France. And for some reason, we did not want to play Australia after what they'd done to us in 86. And thankfully, Blanco scored that wonderful try in the corner. And I still remember Tommy, my nemesis, trying to get to him, pushing him out. And the All Blacks, we all actually cheered that they scored. And then through to the final.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to put the context on that Wales game, 49-6 in a semi-final. That's incredible, especially when it was 4 points for a try as well. That was, you're not going to see that in the modern era,
yeah,
are you?
Yeah, we scored. We played a style of rugby. It was quite un-New Zealand to play that sort of fluid running game, which I don't know if Brian Lahore, if he had devised that, or it was just the calibre of players we had. You know, the John Kerwins. You know, John Gallagher was just out of the blue, became one of our great All Blacks, literally overnight. Mm. You know, a policeman from Wellington that had come down from England to have a bit of an OE and play for Wellington, and then he's playing in a World Cup. So a lot of different players, and we're very lucky, as you know, a lot of World Cup winning teams are. We had no injuries.
Yeah.
And if we did have an injury, we had really good backup. But other than Andy, we had no injuries.
Yeah. So let's get on to the final then. Particularly for you as an Aucklander going to Eden Park back at home, your hometown, home ground, that must have been incredibly special. Despite the fact that there had never been a World Cup final before, you must have felt the sense of occasion.
Yeah, we were nervous. You know, the anticipation of playing the French. And the last time we played the French, we had lost in 86. So that was on the back of our minds, and they had an outstanding team, a really good-looking team, and they played a very similar game to us. But yeah, we were nervous. It was a capacity crowd. Luckily, it was played on a Saturday, not a Sunday. There was a big banner from a Michael Jones fan, and had, thank God, the finals on Saturday, not Sunday, Michael Jones fan, because Michael didn't play on Sundays.
Yeah, devout Christian.
But
yeah.
It was a most beautiful day. Yeah, and Eden Park was a lot different in those days. A lot of open terraces, open stands, but a real sense of occasion. And, you know, World Rugby did an amazing job to get it to that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So of the match itself, again, it probably felt tighter than it was, but 29-9, pretty convincing victory. But was there a moment maybe where you thought, I think we're going to do this? Or was it nip and tuck for you guys, even though the scoreline might not have been?
We had to play well. I sadly for the French, I think they played their final, as the case of many World Cups as we've seen. The French, I think, played their final 7 days earlier against Australia. And to get back to where they were again was going to be difficult. And, you know, we scored, you know, a couple of times in the first half that, you know, sort of really put the screws on them. And once again, we played really well and didn't make too many mistakes.
Yeah,
and no injuries.
Yeah, absolutely. So the emotions of winning it, obviously we've had iconic World Cup final moments over the years, but that was the first one. Did it hit home what you'd done, or because it was the first one, it felt a little bit different? You'd just achieved what you wanted to do, or was it this great outpouring of emotion that happens for other teams?
Yeah, I think as I said at the start, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing. You know, it was about winning the next game, and I think probably the emotion was relief that we'd won the tournament, and New Zealand loved it. So, you know, the All Blacks, you know, were expected to win in New Zealand, and to beat the French was no change. We just had to win that game, and then we could enjoy Sunday and then back to work on Monday.
I was going to say, nowadays, parties, drinking sessions, parades, knighthoods, everything else, but was that as low-key as it got, back to the building site on Monday?
As low-key as it got. I don't think we even had a parade, if I think back. I don't think we had a parade up Queen Street or anything. I think it was just job done. Thank you very much. The 26 of you and the two coaches, or the three coaches, and the one physio, one doctor. Thank you very much. Now, off to work, and you're going to play Australia. I think we played Australia in about 3 weeks' time for a Bledisloe Cup. And that was it. Done job. Now, you know, get back to you. What you've been doing.
Did you get a firm handshake on the building site on Monday, or a little, I don't know, did the boss come and say, well done, mate, or something?
I don't think they, in those days, I think we're back training for Auckland. Club rugby. We were back training down at university at Merton Road in Glen Innes on Tuesday night under lights, I think. That's how it was. Because we had at university, we had four All Blacks. We had John Drake, myself, Foxy and David Kirk all came out of the university club, and we hadn't won the Gallagher Shield for a number of years, so we thought we needed one more international. So Gavin Hastings stayed on and played for university, and understandably we won the trophy that year also.
Yeah,
for the club competition in Auckland.
One of the great university teams of all time, surely, with five legends in there. It's amazing. So did you get you would have got a medal and things like that, would you? Have you still got it? Was it a bit of a piece of tin, or was it quite a nice one?
No, it was just a little downstairs, actually. Just a medal saying World Cup winner.
That's pretty cool.
1987, which is quite special. I've still got my jersey from that game, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you get any sort of other gifts from New Zealand Rugby? I remember for things like Lions tours and stuff in that sort of era, there'd be like a blazer for all the lads going on tour or something like that, or you'd get a little thing to sew onto your pocket. Was there any little trinkets from New Zealand Rugby?
Nothing like that. I think we might have got a silver tray, maybe, from Steinlager, or a couple of beers. But no, I don't think we got anything special. You know, I think just being an All Black was so special. You know, if you play a test match for the All Blacks, you get a special tie. But no, nothing that I can remember.
Yeah.
Which is great. We didn't expect anything in those days.
No.
You don't expect anything. You got a pair of boots from Adidas and that was it. But that was the way it was, and we loved it. I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Lifetime of memories. We're still talking about it now, which is amazing. So, I mean,
and the nice thing also is that we've never had a reunion of the 87 team.
Okay.
We have All Black reunions. So we're no more special than the 88 team or the 1963 team. We just have a reunion every year for All Blacks, and if you're available, you turn up. But no, there's no song and dance about the 87 team.
Yeah, yeah. Did you still find it amazing? Like, obviously, you didn't have the context of what the World Cup would become at the time, but did you find it extraordinary, really, that the All Blacks took so long to win another one? 24 years, didn't it, to 2011 to get the next one?
I don't think we really sort of got our head around it in terms of, which is understandable, that in terms of the preparation, the cycle, the four-year cycle, you know, Graham Henry losing in 07, I think that really taught them how to prepare for a World Cup in terms of the development of players through that four-year cycle. And that's what's so interesting for me about this cycle, how we got it wrong for 3 years. And then all of a sudden, the All Blacks now look as though they could potentially win a World Cup, dare I say. But it's almost in reverse of what we've done in the past. You know, we normally had a bit of a clean out and then built, you know, that 3 to 4 years to culminate with, you know, the 33 players being named. So, you know, it's the pinnacle of your career now to win a World Cup. It's how you're judged on your success at World Cups. And it's the same with coaches. The great coaches have won World Cups.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's, as we talked about at the top, try and sum up maybe how you do win a World Cup or how you guys won it. You've mentioned a few things over the course of the half hour or so of no injuries and getting all the best players together and taking one game at a time. But can you put your finger on maybe a couple of key elements you think that may be true for yours and all World Cup wins?
Yeah, injuries is, you know, it's always going to be a hindrance. But, you know, the preparation is key, the planning, where you're going, who you're playing against, the development of players in that cycle, making sure you have players that are really, really, really hungry to win a World Cup. And that's where you have issues in terms of, you know, players. I played in three World Cups, and you've got to make sure that the players that are playing in two or three World Cups, if they're still young enough and good enough and all those things, they've still got that burning desire to win the World Cup, because you need... You know, now you need 33 dedicated players that have a burning desire to be the best in the world and take everything else out of your life, but winning that World Cup, and if you've got 33 players doing that, it's pretty hard to beat. You need a good 9, good 10. You know, the best teams in the world that have won World Cups have a great 10 to drive the game, and you need a good leader. You need a good leader to make sure that everything is in place to win. And then if that's not enough, you also need a very good coaching team. Because I say it again, the best teams that win World Cups have great great captains, great tens, and they also have good coaches.
Yeah, well, there you go. There's the blueprint, everyone. We're going to try and pick through more over the
course. It's not much, is it?
No, exactly, yeah. But Sean Fitzpatrick, look, absolute pleasure to rip through 1987 with you. All the best for you guys, and enjoy the tournament that's coming in France.
Thank you very much. I can't wait. It's going to be a fabulous World Cup, and hopefully the All Blacks will get through.
You've been listening to a Ruck podcast special, How to Win the World Cup. Like and subscribe, spread the word, and follow the Times on social media at Timesport. And we'll have another episode for you soon. This podcast was produced by Alfie Reynolds.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.